KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I'm very excited to have on the show Professor Peter Lee of UC Davis School of Law. Peter is someone who writes extensively in patent law, as well as technology transfer issues and what we broadly term open science or open collaboration. This is a topic broadly that is of significant importance, not only to the operations of universities, which we'll be talking about, but also to how we innovate and how we move technologies from the laboratory to the market, or from the research lab to the market. And what Peter focuses on, and he's focused on in a number of articles, is how patent law interacts with this activity. So where patent law works, where it doesn't, and what we might do with it in the context primarily of innovation and technology transfer. And Peter's had a number of articles in the last few years that have touched on this, and he's also, very interestingly, and we'll talk about it, teaching a course at UC Davis Law School this semester called Innovation and Technology Transfer Seminar, having reviewed the syllabus and looked at the readings, and we'll talk about it a bit, is a very interesting tailored seminar discussing these issues, the kind of course where I would take it if I wasn't living about 2,500 miles away and didn't have my own teaching responsibilities. But I mention here that down the road, if I'm able to teach a course like this, this would be a syllabus that I will seek for guidance. But Peter's work is very relevant to the academic endeavor today, as patenting has become a primary activity of research universities, and technology transfer issues have been the subject of increasing debate, focusing primarily, and we'll talk about it, on how commercialization of research at universities has impacted the operations of universities, patent law, and ultimately what we mean by sharing information and by collaborative science. By way of brief background, Peter graduated from Yale Law School, where he was a member of the Yale Law Journal. He joined the faculty at UC Davis after clerking for Judge Barry Silverman for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He received his undergrad degree from Harvard University, and he's had a number of articles published, and his primary focuses are intellectual property, patent law, and property. So with that introduction, Peter is joining us by Skype from his home in Davis, California. Peter, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Peter, let's start off with a question that I ask most of my guests, which is a bit more about your background and how you particularly became interested in patent law and technology transfer issues.
Sure. Well, I guess we have to go back a few years, and I would actually go back to my undergraduate studies. I think like a lot of people, when I entered college, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to major in. I happened to be very interested in science. I had considered being pre-med and going off to medical school, but I also really liked history, and I liked the social sciences. And so I kind of torn between these two different directions, I ended up finding the perfect major. So I studied the history and philosophy of science. And for me, it's just a very intriguing intersection of two very different cultures. So we often think of science as somewhat objective, somewhat clinical, but it does unfold in a social, political, and legal context, and I was able to examine this by studying the history and philosophy of science. So fast forward a few years, I ended up going to law school. I was interested in legal academia, wasn't exactly sure in which area I'd do most of my writing, but when I took my first intellectual property class, everything that I had learned in undergrad, all of these themes, really resonated. So here again, it's a perfect illustration of science and technology being subject to statutes, regulations, public policy, and so forth. So I find this mix thought to be very interesting, and it's one that I very much enjoy exploring today.
Where you teach at UC Davis, obviously, you're near and in technology centers. I'm curious, given your geography, how that or does that impact the research as well as the teaching that you do?
Well, absolutely. So, you know, we are in Northern California. We're not that far from Silicon Valley. We're also near a lot of the origins of the biotech industry in California. And so it's great to draw upon, you know, both practitioners and scholars who focused on the developments of these industries. In addition, UC Davis in particular is particularly strong in agricultural biotechnology. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've had a number of discussions with people on campus who are experts in those areas as well. And kind of translating to the teaching, we tend to attract a lot of students who are interested in IP, which is obviously very gratifying as an IP professor. So, you know, we always have very good subscriptions for the intellectual property survey course, even for patent law. And then, as you mentioned in the intro, this seminar on innovation and technology transfer.
You're writing, and again, this is by way of background for those that might not be familiar with your work. You clearly have produced a number of articles over the last few years, and therefore have an agenda in your scholarship. What is it? What are you seeking ultimately to do with the body of work that you've developed so far, and perhaps where you've headed?
Right. Sure. So, if I had to articulate a theme, I'd say that a lot of my pieces focus on the institutional context of innovation. So obviously, patent law exists. It's a body of doctrines that are aimed at promoting technological progress and innovation, but all laws unfold in particular contexts. And here again, I think we can see some of the antecedents from my undergraduate studies. And so I'm really interested to see how science and how patent law unfold in institutional context. So I focused a lot, for example, on federal funding for basic research, primarily biomedical research. A lot of this funding is then actually taken up by university researchers, so there's a whole academic component to innovation. And then obviously at some point, at least hopefully, this technology is then transferred to the private sector. So we have a number of different institutions and a number of different, I would say, institutional norms that are involved in innovation. So, you know, speaking very schematically, traditionally, universities, you know, nonprofit research institutions seem to draw from very different norms than for-profit concerns or for-profit firms that are ultimately commercializing technologies. But in patent law and in tech transfer, these two realms have to intersect.
And so, you know, it's, you know, as one of the benefits of being not only the host of this show, but the person that invites all the guests and puts everything together is that I kind of get to pick and choose topics. So, you know, your focus is also a focus of mine, but I focus on trade secrecy and how right. Trade secrecy has been used by private entities providing public infrastructure, and now I'm working on a piece where I look at the opposite situation. Governments serving what have traditionally been markets that have been dominated by private entities as opposed to the government. And so our interests are similar, although you focus more on patents. I'm curious to ask you this question, therefore, and as we contextualize this, again, for listeners who aren't familiar, what is the traditional role of the patent? I've had a number of guests on the show where we've talked about what a patent is, but particularly mm-hmm. related to your work, how do you conceive the proper domain of patent law? What are its limitations, if any?
Sure. So there are a number of different ways in which I could approach that question. Let me try one. So, you know, as I'm sure your audience is aware, patents are exclusive rights on inventions. And so you get a 20-year term of exclusive rights. And patents provide a number of incentives, most notably an incentive to invent, right? So if I have the power to exclude others from using my invention, that provides me with some assurance that if I invest a lot of time and capital in developing an invention, I can actually reap some of those rewards. And so certainly patents play that function. They play other functions as well, some of which are particularly relevant to university patenting and technology transfer. So, you know, one could argue, well, it seems rather odd to allow university researchers who are drawing upon federal funds to do their research to then be able to patent the results of their research. But it seems here that you don't need the expectation of market returns to motivate that investment in research. You're getting a grant from the government. So perhaps you have a grant from the National Institutes of Health. They're covering all of your research expenditures. Why then should you be able to patent the results of, again, this taxpayer-funded research? Well, you know, this just illustrates the fact that patents play a number of different roles in different contexts. So it is true that this public funding probably satisfies the motivation to invent, but you might actually want or need exclusive rights to motivate additional investments in commercialization. So you might have a completed university invention, it's patented, but in the absence of exclusive rights, some private firm will not invest the millions and millions of dollars it often takes to take that patented invention into being a commercially available product.
And so that gets to the nexus of the issue, and it's something I'm teaching IP survey right now, and I regularly challenge my students to question whether the utilitarian theory, that standard theory in IP law that says that we need to incentivize creation by giving a limited monopoly or a right to exclude, I mean, depending on the regime. But we need to do this because the pecuniary interest of the inventor is paramount. And I always ask my students to question whether that's true, whether our standard story holds up across the board. Now, here we're dealing with a reality that universities have not been traditionally conceived as entities whose primary function is to generate revenue. And yet we've seen this transition, and I think that's a transition I want to start focusing on, but we need to have some basic understanding by way of background. So let me ask you to define a few terms for me and a few areas of law so that we can get into more of the meat. What is a commons in the context of patents? What does that look like?
Okay. All right. So I guess it may actually make sense to first start in the real property context.
Okay.
So, you know, what is a real property commons? You can think of something like Boston Common, so a public park that's open to all comers. So in general, I think a commons refers to a legal context in which some resource, and in this case it could be land, is widely available to a particular community or for a particular range of uses. And so in the context of scientific research, a commons would relate to certain resources, certain discoveries that in theory should be available to all members of the community. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk, particularly in the sociology of science, about the tradition of open science. And I think that this tradition of open science refers very directly to the idea of a commons, that, you know, a scientist may be able to discover some new law or some new property of nature, and maybe she can even name it. But she doesn't really have exclusive rights over that discovery. In fact, these discoveries are widely available to all other scientists. And this is really how science progresses, right? So we build upon the discoveries of earlier scientists. And so no one has really strict proprietary rights in discoveries. And so one of the criticisms of patents, in particular academic patenting, is that patents seem to encroach upon this idea of the commons, or this idea of open science, where in fact scientists are patenting the results of oftentimes very basic research. Oftentimes these discoveries are very useful for other scientists who want to conduct their research, but in fact, to the extent that we have proprietary rights on them, it actually inhibits this collective progress.
So the challenge when we think about patents here is again this issue of privatizing, of building that proverbial wall or fence around around a particular invention, which gets to the opposite, and you've used the phrase before, and I just want to make sure that we're specific about it. What do we mean by open science? I mean, what again does that look like? Again, for purposes of our discussion of how it works in universities.
Sure. So open science refers to this tradition whereby resources, knowledge, techniques are widely available to the entire scientific community in order to, again, allow people to draw from these common resources and engage in their own research. So, you know, if we actually want to begin introducing a discussion of patent law,
right.
many people have considered things like DNA sequences, which are very foundational for biomedical research. People consider that these things probably should not be patented in certain contexts, precisely because we want this openness. We want other scientists to be able to freely use these resources for their own research.
So this leads us now to getting into a little more detail here. So we're drilling down on how universities use patents, which under the law, and I'll have you explain in more detail, under the law is the regime that policymakers have decided should be used in a university context. So trade
right.
secrecy is not available, and copyright and trademark are largely irrelevant to the discussion. So let's talk about that, and I guess my first question is, for those that aren't familiar with how research and development has been done versus how it's done now in the context of patenting, this is, I know, a question that could, where you could give a solid two-hour lecture, so I'm going to ask for, but we do have time on this show where you don't have to give a 30-second answer either. How do universities use patents today? And then the follow-up question I'll ask is if you could describe that history with reference to the Bayh-Dole Act. But let's start with the first question. So how do universities use patents in 2010? Is there a standard way or a standard story that we can tell?
Right. So after the Bayh-Dole Act, and I know we're going to talk about it in a few moments, universities can take title to inventions that arise from federal funding. And so there's almost kind of a presumption, you know, not one that's exactly spelled out in statute, but a presumption that universities can patent these resources. Actually, it's a little bit difficult to generalize in this area because different universities have different policies and practices. Let me try to identify, though, a few somewhat transcendent practices.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, universities do use patents and the prospect of issuing exclusive licenses as mechanisms to achieve technology transfer. So just to kind of walk you through the mechanics, mm-hmm. A university scientist will discover some patentable invention, he or she will disclose it to a university office called oftentimes an office of technology transfer. There will be then some internal assessment on the part of that office to see, number one, is this invention actually patentable? And secondly, is there a market such that it would actually make sense to patent this resource? If the answer to those questions are both yes, then oftentimes the university will expend oftentimes quite a bit of money in patenting this invention, and then that initiates a stage of actually trying to identify potential private firms to which you could license this resource. So kind of a short answer to your question is that universities are using patents as mechanisms for technology transfer, for moving discoveries outside of university laboratories into the private sector for commercialization.
Now, the context here is one that I want to explore a bit more before we take a step back and talk about Bayh-Dole and what happened pre-Bayh-Dole. What is the relationship? And again, I know it's difficult to generalize, so maybe I'll make it simpler for you. Just say your standard large American research university, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, where a significant amount of resources are put towards research as opposed to classroom teaching and other roles of a university. What is the intersection of this paradigmatic university professor and the private sector? Because obviously funding is a huge issue, and a lot of the research that's done not only on private university campuses but publicly funded campuses are funded by private entities that obviously have an interest in the research. So can you talk generally, before we get into specifics, about what that relationship looks like?
So between the university inventor and the actual private sector?
And the private sector, and the private sector perhaps funder, or certainly the entity
right.
with whom that professor might have a contractual relationship independent
right.
perhaps of the university itself.
Right. So as you mentioned, there is a phenomenon of sponsored research whereby private firms, you know, this could be in biotech, in information technology, in any number of industries, private firms will actually fund individual research laboratories at universities, because presumably that particular scientist is pursuing research of interest to the firm. So there is a relationship between that individual scientist and a private sector firm. Oftentimes it's actually mediated, though, by the technology transfer office.
Okay.
So oftentimes in terms of sponsored research, there are certain expectations. Some of them may actually be memorialized in contract, whereby if I'm a firm and I'm sponsoring some research at a university, I want the first right of refusal for any exclusive licenses that may arise from patent inventions. So there's a very direct relationship between the technology transfer office, the individual scientist, and the commercial firm. Even aside from this, though, there are a lot of ways in which individual scientists interact with private firms. So oftentimes, even in the context of a kind of traditional licensing arrangement, so a university licenses some technology out to a private sector firm, the actual individual inventor is very involved in tech transfer. And this actually kind of relates to some research I'm doing now on the concept of tacit knowledge. There's a lot of knowledge that's just simply resident in the inventor's mind, in that scientist's mind, that's very difficult to codify. So it may actually not be disclosed in a patent, but yet it may be very valuable, perhaps even necessary, for effectively practicing that invention or adapting it to certain commercial pursuits. And so oftentimes, you know, in parallel to formal patenting and licensing, you see actual university scientists being incorporated into the management team of private sector firms, or perhaps, you know, having an equity stake or being an outside scientific advisor, all with the eye toward having that inventor transfer some of that tacit knowledge to the firm.
So it's you've triggered something that I'm focusing on in my own work, which basically focuses on how trade secrecy or how patent law, certain modifications of patent law, could wind up channeling inventors towards trade secrecy, which
right.
which I generally think is a bad thing. As
right.
compare if I compare the two, which is a bit of a normative judgment, but one that I've focused on. So we're talking to Peter Lee, a professor at UC Davis School of Law and KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Last background question for you, Peter, before we talk about Baidoa. So who's in the tech transfer office? I mean, who are these people? Are these lawyers? Are they university administrators? Are they scientists? What do these
right.
offices tend to look like?
Right. So it's a great question. And as you can probably surmise, there's a lot of variability. So in many cases, you have actual lawyers there, which makes sense because lawyers have to make the initial determinations of whether or not these inventions are patentable and so forth. Oftentimes, you do have former scientists there as well, and sometimes you even combine these expertise. So you might have a PhD who has some background, let's say, in biotechnology, who also happens to have gone to law school and can also speak to the patentability of an invention. Oftentimes, you have people from industry, so people from biotech or information technology who are, again, familiar with the technology and may have certain connections to industry players. Increasingly, I would say you have business, management, marketing people who are involved in technology transfer offices. And this makes a lot of sense because one of the primary functions is to advertise these inventions to the market at large mm-hmm. to see if anybody wants to license them.
And so, of course, the players that are making these decisions, of course, engraft their own values into the decisions that are being made, which gets us back to the role of the university and what collaborative science looks like, which is something we're going to talk about after the break. So we have a few minutes left before we take a very short break, and I do want to ask you now about Baidoa. And so again, you know, you don't have to give the 30-second answer, but in 2 or 3 minutes, what is Baidoa? What is this
sure.
mysterious law?
Right, so we've been talking about it. Let's address it more centrally. So the Baidoa Act was passed by Congress in 1980, and it essentially changed federal kind of science and research and technology transfer policy. So under Baidoa, recipients of federal grants can actually patent the results of taxpayer-financed research. So just to provide an example, let's say that I'm a UC Davis cancer researcher. I applied to the National Institutes of Health for a grant I get some money. Obviously, this is taxpayer money, and I conduct some research, and I develop a patentable invention. Well, under Bayh-Dole, I guess, more operatively, my university can take title to this patented invention. And this seems in some ways a bit odd because, after all, it is the U.S. taxpayer who's funding this research that produces this invention. Well, why don't we have the NIH or the federal government at large own this invention? And so we kind of have to go into the history of Bayh-Dole a little bit prior to 1980. So prior to Bayh-Dole, there were actually a lot of different agency-specific policies that were in play on the part of the federal government. And so, in fact, I think, estimates differ, but around 24 different policies from different federal agencies as to whether or not they would actually take title to the patent invention or if they would allow some grantee to take title to the patent invention.
So only 24 separate policies, at least.
There we go.
That's right. Lending clarity to the law. Good, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And so as a result of this, in a large number of cases, the federal government or a federal agency actually did take title to the patent invention, and there was some intuition that we had all these patent inventions, but they were not being put to good use. So there was some concern, there was some anxiety that we had these patent inventions. The federal government was quite reluctant to issue exclusive licenses, but in the absence of exclusive rights, private firms would not step in, license these technologies, and actually produce commercial products. So, there are a lot of concerns about this, and it's really tied up in economic history in a sense. So think back to the 1970s, there are worries about lagging U.S. economic competitiveness relative to Japan and Europe, and members of Congress were looking for ways to stimulate the economy and innovation. And actually, in some ways, we're in a similar situation in 2010.
Mm-hmm. And that's I'm sorry.
Oh, so I was just going to say, so that's kind of part of the economic and political motivation behind the Bayh-Dole Act. So, instead of allowing federal agencies to retain title to these patent inventions, let's allow the grantee, the university, to take title to these inventions. The universities could then exclusively license these technologies out to the private sector, thus promoting innovation.
And getting those inventions off the shelf.
Exactly.
It's which is what we'll talk about after the break, which is what that means to university, and that'll get us even deeper into your research. KZSU, for those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. The Tech Transfer Office at KZSU has not gone very far in funding the radio station. This is the kind of geeky IP humor that you get on Hearsay Culture. For those of you that would like to consider making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of ways you could do this. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you could go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue listening to the show. So, Peter, it sounds like an obvious question, but it's also an important one. Given the existence of tech transfer offices, of this strong commercialization effort, which clearly has benefits to society, there's also a cost associated in a university. And so, how do commercialization efforts at universities impact the academic environment? I know there's a lot of literature here and a lot of criticism of Bayh-Dole that it's turned universities into little more than businesses, and that collaborative science is no longer exists and so forth. From a top level approach, before we drill down, what's your reaction to those criticisms? I mean, what has the impact ultimately been in your view?
Right. So it's a great question. It's kind of a $1 million question that a lot of people are investigating. As you mentioned, there is a broad literature on this. So there are anxieties that we've actually seen a change in academic culture. And so kind of relating back to our earlier discussion of open science, we used to have these normative expectations where discoveries were open to everybody. And in fact, that seems to be changing. Oftentimes, the default presumption is that, if it is patentable, we'll at least consider patenting it. And kind of on a related note, we have some anxiety that we're actually changing research agendas on the part of professors. So, you know, given two potential paths, one which has a more immediate commercial application and the other one which is more kind of in the traditional realm of basic science, one might face an incentive to pursue that first path because there is this potential prospect of a patent further along down the line. Kind of abstracting away from that a bit more structurally, people have argued that, you know, we may actually be changing the allocation of resources within universities themselves. So an IP professor that you and I are both familiar with, Brett Frischman, has made this argument that we're actually changing the infrastructural makeup of universities so as to favor certain lines of research that lead to commercial products. So all of these are anxieties. The difficulty, of course, is empirically verifying this. So, you know, how do you actually empirically verify a change in a normative culture? It's very difficult, but there are definite concerns about the influence of Bayh-Dole on university culture.
What, having raised the question or raised the issue, I do want to ask you, is there any empirical evidence suggesting this change? I mean, given that it's difficult, it may not be much, but is there, have you seen any or have you come across any?
Right. So the little that I've come across suggests that research agendas are not changing that much. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind here is that historically there used to be a sharper distinction between basic and applied research. Obviously, this line has always been fuzzy to a certain extent.
And I do want to interrupt you for those that don't know. What's the difference between basic and applied?
So basic research is really aimed at kind of some fundamental understanding of some natural property. So it's, you know, kind of in a rarefied sense, seeking knowledge for its own sake. You know, I simply want to understand how this organ system works. You know, more applied research has a bit more of a pragmatic, one can almost say commercial tinge to it. You're not aimed simply or necessarily at understanding some fundamental natural property. You actually want to do something with it. So you want to actually develop a medicine, you want to develop some sort of treatment, and so forth. So as I mentioned, there's never been a very clear demarcation between basic and applied research. Arguably, it was a bit sharper. More recently, though, this line has gotten even fuzzier. So given that so much research is both, in a sense, basic and applied, so it's aimed at fundamental understanding, but it also has direct pragmatic applications, it doesn't seem like research agendas are changing that much. So, you know, we're doing the basic research, but again, that basic research is intrinsically applied in some sense, and so there doesn't seem to be that much of a negative impact in that context. Just to cite one other kind of empirical note, there have been some concerns that with the prospect of patenting, academics would become less productive. So they would focus less on traditional research and publishing and focus more of their energies on patenting and commercialization. Empirical studies that I've seen suggest that, in fact, that's not the case, that the professors who patent the most are also the most productive along the traditional metrics of academia, namely publishing in scientific journals. So again, that also suggests, and again, it's just one data point, that we're not having a hugely negative impact on academic culture.
And so it's, you know, it's always good to have empirical data to test our theories, because that is, I think, counterintuitive. Those are counterintuitive results, because we make assumptions that these values will drive people's personal agendas and motivations, which gets to a even broader discussion again about the utilitarian theory and why people actually do what they do. With regard to the policies themselves, okay, so at least what we can look at in the empirical data that we can actually analyze would be, what do the policies say? Do the policies that you've seen, and I know they vary, but I'll ask the general question, as a general matter, do the tech transfer policies that you've seen reflect the traditional concepts of open science and open collaboration, or are they written in a way that would suggest that that piece of empirical data suggests that there is an impact?
Right. So I guess the theme of the day is distinctions. I guys are drawing another distinction.
I'm just trying to confuse everyone. So, you know, that's my goal.
Right. So, you know, one distinction that I'll draw is that between older, kind of more sophisticated technology transfer offices and newer entrants in the field. And, you know, obviously it's difficult to generalize, but it seems to be the case that older, more sophisticated technology transfer offices tend to place more emphasis on maintaining these traditional norms of open science. So one example, oftentimes technology transfer offices, when they license and even exclusively license some invention out to the private sector, they will include a reserved research exemption in that license. So yes, you, a commercial firm, you have exclusive rights to bring this product to market and to sell it, but we, the university, will retain the right to use this invention for non-commercial academic research purposes, and we will also allow other nonprofit academic research institutions to do the same. So, you know, this somewhat complicates, and I think in a very beneficial way, our notions of patents. So the broad context is that we are allowing exclusive rights on these resources, but we carve out little pockets of open science or of research commonses within this proprietary landscape. And again, I would say generally that's more characteristic of the older, more sophisticated technology transfer offices, which are not, I think, as concerned with maximizing licensing revenues.
And that gets to one of the pieces that you've written, contracting to preserve open science, consideration-based regulation and patent law. You know, we talk right. about, you know, from the broadest perspective, you know, when we talk about intellectual property law and shortcomings perhaps of copyright law or patent law, what I at least focus my students on is that there are ways to hack these shortcomings by using other regimes to get the result that you want. And so we can use contracts to get around problems that we might have when copyright fails to create the licensing mechanism that we want and so forth. Your piece that I mentioned, I think, gets to that issue. So I'll ask you again, and this is a lengthy article, I recognize, and even in a roughly hour long interview, I also recognize that we can only touch tip of the iceberg on these ideas. But what is consideration based regulation, and how does that impact the discussion that we're having?
Right. So it draws very organically from what you were saying about kind of contracting and private ordering as mechanisms for, you know, modifying these regimes of intellectual property that are codified in statute. So, you know, consideration-based regulation speaks to the fact that public institutions, and I interpret that term broadly to include the federal government, state governments, universities, even nonprofits and disease advocacy groups, public institutions make a number of contributions to research. And I focus primarily in the piece on biomedical research. In a sense, there's a potential quid pro quo or exchange relationship that can arise. So, you know, we can look at universities again. I'm a university. I have patented some very valuable invention, and I'm willing to offer a license to a private sector firm. So in a sense, I'm offering something of value. You might think of this as consideration in an exchange. Well, being an exchange, I as a university may want something in return. Mm-hmm. That something in return doesn't necessarily have to be monetary remuneration. You know, I might ask for royalties, but that may not be what I'm most interested in. My exchange might be, or what I get in exchange, might be maintaining this particular resource in a research commons so that other academic scientists, academic researchers can use it without a license. So, you know, when universities are transferring technology to the private sector, they're offering assets of incredible value. Universities can legitimately ask for something in return, and that might be keeping these things open, at least in certain contexts.
So it gets us to, and we have about, you know, we have about 12 minutes left, where I start getting to what I call the unfair questions portion of the show, where I ask questions that you can't possibly answer in the time we have left. I do my best to try to make tailored questions to avoid that. And we're chatting with Peter Lee of UC Davis School of Law on KZSU and Hearsay Culture. Ultimately, you know, I think your research does get at a core question, which is whether patent law is up to the task, and whether patent law can really handle this. So are patents the best method or the best regime to achieve open science, if that's our goal, despite the fact that we want to bring these products to market, and so we need a mechanism to allow universities to do that?
Right. So It's a difficult question. I think that patents definitely have a role to play in maintaining norms of open science. So, yeah, let me start with a few preliminary observations. On the one hand, you might think that patents are totally antithetical to open science, you know, to the extent that open science is predicated on everybody having access to a resource. It seems like the opposite would be to allow one individual to have proprietary rights on that asset. As several commentators have pointed out, though, there are ways in which patents are actually quite consistent with traditional norms of science, including open science. So number one, patents do provide an additional incentive for research and development, which is largely consistent with the program of traditional science. In addition, of course, to get a patent, you have to disclose your invention. And there's a strong norm of disclosure in open science. So I think that, you know, patents can play an interesting role in maintaining open science. And I'm actually quite enthusiastic about what I'm seeing in terms of public institutions using the mechanisms of private ordering and using patent law, in a sense, to exercise some control over these resources. So, you know, I like the model where resources are patented and they're exclusively licensed to promote commercialization, you know, if and when exclusive rights are necessary for commercialization, but that for other types of perhaps users or uses, we're still going to maintain wide access to the resource.
Yeah, and you know, the perspective that we take on patent law, I think, is so key because, as you know, there are many critics of patent law that condemn the regime, and many of them have been on the show. You know, David Levine, no relation, and Kelly Boldrin have written in Against Monopoly that patent law should just be thrown out entirely. And then, you know, people like Mike Moyer and Mark Lemley and Dan Burke have said we need to significantly change the system that we have. And, of course, the debate is what we need to change and how we conceptualize patents. You know, my perspective as someone that focuses on trade secrecy is that patent law is great, simply because it has the disclosure mandate in it, even though the disclosures themselves can be hacked and don't disclose as much as we might think or want and so forth. But the perspective is important, and I ask myself this in the context of trade secrecy, and I'll ask you the same question in the context of patents. How much scientific production do you think, and again, the empirical data isn't fully developed, but what's your hunch? How much scientific development would we still have in the absence of patent law in universities? So we think back to the pre-Bayh-Dole age, really, but we're not in the world of the 1970s. We're now in 2010, and we have a more robust and developed, or we have more robust and developed theories of innovation that don't involve the utilitarian theory. What's your hunch today? If we removed patent law from the equation, what would we be getting out of universities?
Right. So I guess one thing I want to mention relates to back to what you were saying earlier. You know, I am not necessarily a categorical cheerleader in favor of the current patent statute and the way that the patent law is on the books. I think what I want to emphasize, though, is that there is a difference between patent law on the books and how it actually plays out in a variety of institutional contexts. So mm-hmm. The patent on the books might be the opening stage of a negotiation, but then universities, other public institutions, and so forth can actually leverage their own resources such that patent law plays out differently in practice. To get back to your other question, you know, I think that we'd actually have a significant amount of scientific production in the absence of university patenting. So here again, you know, to the extent that this research is funded by federal agencies like the National Institutes of Health, we have, you know, well-developed university infrastructures for supporting scientific research, I think we would have a very robust scientific community even in the absence of patenting. Where I think that you might run into some difficulties is in actually translating those scientific discoveries into technological products, into actual commercialized marketable products. And I think that this, again, just kind of recapitulates the rationale behind Bayh-Dole. That being said, even if we didn't allow patents, I think we still would see a fair degree of commercialization. So, you know, I'm sure that, you know, you've written on this, other people have written on this. There are lots of other motivations besides patents and exclusivity that encourage private firms to take up productive paths of research and development. So, you know, there's first mover advantage, There are, you know, certain intrinsic advantages to developing a certain expertise in an area. So I don't think necessarily that if we eliminated patents, all innovation would grind to a halt. I think that patents are important in certain contexts and that firms do respond to that exclusivity, but there are other motivations that also encourage commercial activity.
And yeah, and that's, and again, that's where, you know, I think, and I keep mentioning this, but I think it's just because it resonates so much. I mean, that's where my research is headed, focusing on ways that we can channel entities that would use trade secrecy towards patents and why we want to do that.
Right.
And so that's a particular interest of mine. In the remaining 6 or 7 minutes that we have, I do want to talk about your course, which I think is very interesting. So, Innovation and Technology Transfer Seminar. I'm curious. This is almost an inside baseball law school question. But I'm curious about it. How many students have enrolled in it, and what's been the experience thus far? Obviously, we're in the middle of the semester, but what's your sense of how it's going?
Right. So I have 12 students, and it's actually been a great experience thus far. I should mention that this is the first time I've ever offered a seminar. So I've learned a lot. Hopefully, the students have learned a lot. But we have really robust discussions. And, you know, I guess you and I would find things like innovation policy interesting. Perhaps the average person would not be as enthused, but you know, it's very gratifying to see these law students who are really talking about the debates leading up to Bayh-Dole. They're talking about whether or not commercialization is having a negative impact on academic norms, you know, the proper role of the federal government and agencies like the NIH in promoting commercialization. So a lot of very robust discussions. I'll just mention as well, I structured the course so that the students will be writing a paper, and in fact, they will each be presenting their papers in the class. We went around last week, and we actually discussed what those topics would be, and students are writing about some really interesting topics, everything from clean tech and the Obama administration's interest in funding clean tech to comparative technology transfer practices in China and Japan. So I'm very much looking forward to their papers.
And I should note that we're recording a show on October 22nd, but the show will air a couple of weeks from now. Peter, in terms of, and this is something I'm always interested in, it should be received wisdom, but I suspect that it isn't as received as it should be, that your teaching will inform your scholarship, and your scholarship informs your teaching. So logically, from that perspective, we want people in the classroom to be writing in the areas in which they teach. Your sense thus far, obviously this is a seminar tailored directly towards what you write about. Have you sensed that dynamic exists and is happening for you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So in terms of research informing teaching, you know, a lot of these sources that we're reading in class are sources that I had to read and I cited in my 2 or 3 previous articles. So there's a direct relationship there. And, you know, it's very gratifying to develop at least some modest level of expertise in an area and be able to share it with your students. And in terms of then teaching informing research, so this very much relates to my next research project, which I referred to a bit earlier. So I'm very interested in kind of this concept of tacit knowledge kind of native knowledge in an inventor's mind and how that actually moves from a university lab into the private sector to aid commercialization.
And so, you know, in the last couple of minutes, I do want to talk about this next project because, we talk a lot about attempting to compartmentalize people's brains. So, human beings are supposed to somehow sort knowledge based upon where they received it and how they received it. And of course, we know that that as human beings, we can't do that. Or at least it's extremely difficult to do. And if it's extremely difficult for us to do in our brains, then the law is going to be challenged even more in attempting to regulate it. What's your preliminary read on that issue as you think about tacit knowledge? I mean, I recognize that this is your next project, but do you have some initial thoughts on that very vexing question?
Right. So I think it is very difficult to compartmentalize. I think additionally, it's very difficult to codify. So it's very difficult to take knowledge from your mind and actually put it into some sort of written form that's actually quite transferable on the market. And so, you know, again, it's very much a work in progress, but I'm thinking about potential implications of tacit knowledge. You know, it might highlight certain frailties of patent law itself. So to the extent that you need to disclose an invention in order to obtain a patent, you know, that's traditionally viewed as a quid pro quo behind patent protection. Well, there's only so much that you can disclose in a patent application. And in fact, you might not be disclosing a lot of the really important tacit knowledge that's necessary to practice or adapt a particular invention. So, you know, instead of seeing the patent itself as a conduit for transferring technical information, perhaps we need actual face-to-face interactions between inventors and commercializers to transfer that native knowledge.
I'll ask you this last question, Peter, which is related, but a little bit off topic. You're and this is something I'm working on. You're familiar with the patent reform proposal that eliminates basically best mode to have any meaning in terms of patent enforceability. So you have to give your best mode. You have to disclose, and for those aren't familiar, the best method of practicing your invention that you're aware of at the time that you file the application. But if you don't, it's not grounds for invalidating your patent, and there really is no harm that can be vested upon you. That's the reform proposal. In a minute, literally, what's your reaction to that proposal? I mean, I'm certainly not a fan of it. I think that we don't want to diminish whatever disclosure is in the patents, even though there may be marginal benefit from it, and even though it can cause some litigation, which some people don't like. What's your thought on eliminating best mode from an enforceability perspective?
Right. So it's a difficult issue, and I would say that, you know, there again is a law in the books and there's a law in practice. So in theory, I actually support as much disclosure as possible, you know, within certain, constraints of reasonableness. And so in theory, I actually like the best mode requirement. I like the fact that if the inventor has subjective knowledge of the best way of practicing an invention, he or she must disclose it. The problem, I think, is the law in practice. And so this is, and you're aware of this, this is seen as a trap for the unwary. Mm-hmm. So people currently, they don't disclose the best mode. They don't know that they were supposed to. Then later on in litigation, their patent ends up being invalidated. Another complication here is that in some ways there are benefits to harmonization. So harmonizing U.S. patent law with international standards, many other jurisdictions don't actually have a best mode requirement. So perhaps there might be some gains to harmonizing our system with prevailing kind of global norms. So I guess, you know, in theory, I'm in support of the best mode requirement. In practice, it has given rise to some enforcement difficulties.
For those people, Peter, that want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
So I welcome people to come to my webpage on the UC Davis School of Law website, and my email address is there as well. So if people want to contact me, I welcome that. And if people want to continue the conversation, that'd be great.
Peter, thanks much for joining us on the show. I was very happy and excited to have the opportunity to discuss tech transfer issues. I welcome you back on the show in the future to continue the discussion. But thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and chatting with our audience.
Well, thank you very much. I very much appreciate the opportunity.
The pleasure was all mine. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests coming on that will be further analyzing some of these issues and discussing others. Among them are Professor Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future Humanity Institute and a professor at the University of Oxford, Professor Adrian Johns at the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy, Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford CIS, Sarah Rose, author of the book For All the Tea in China, Professor Greg Lestauka of Rutgers University Law Camden, author of the book Virtual Justice, and Professor Tim Wu of Columbia Law School, author of The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can pick up the show the best way, which is listening live on KZSU from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. But you can also get the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com or subscribing through Stanford CIS's iTunes page or by going to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. thank you very much for listening to the show. I always welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. But I look forward to talking to you next week, and please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. Have a great day.